And for those of you that are new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial for how to use this podcast. When you hear the bell ding, that means that you should look on your device to see what paper we're referencing to back up what we're saying. But if you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether or not you want to take it or leave it.
Happy match to all you residency programs out there. A special congratulations to our brand new interns here at the University of Arizona in Tucson. We are psyched to have you all start in July, and we want to welcome you to the program. This month on the podcast, we talk about ovarian torsion, the fertility portion of the life, limb, sight, and fertility-threatening problems that we as EM docs have to diagnose and treat. Fortunately, it's not super common, but it's common enough that you don't want to miss it, and several of us have. And it finally gets us away from the MRI rut that we've been stuck in for the last couple months, at least for a little while. We are also fortunate to have one of our ultrasound fellows, Dr. Steve Irving, join us, along with Steve's accent. And Chris Williams is here too. But enough chit-chat. Time is ovary, and now is ovary time. So we are back. I hope everybody did well on the in-service. I'm sure you all did. I'm sure there's going to be no issues whatsoever. But in case there are, as Brian said, there's always next year. So, and we're going to talk about ovarian torsion, one of those white unicorns that's just out there. You know it exists maybe somewhere.
More of a white whale, maybe.
This is the white whale, except that you don't want to find it, you know? At some point, you hope you do. Like, my white whale is cholera. I kind of want to diagnose cholera and diphtheria.
I have two white whales, if we want to go on this tangent. One is the gonococcal pharyngitis, and the other is the D-dimer negative PE positive on CT.
I can get a radiologist to misread a CT that well. So this is that thing that we're always looking for, but you never quite find it. Maybe it's the dragon that, chasing that dragon, but you never quite get it.
Come and get me.
We have pelvic pain come in all the time. In the pediatric ED, where we see up to 21 and sometimes up to 81, we are a pelvic pain center of excellence. And it seems like anyone with an ovary is going to get an ultrasound or an MRI or some kind of imaging, because we're always afraid of missing ovarian torsion. So to have this discussion about something that few people have actually seen, because you have to be practicing for a while to see it, we have Chris Williams here.
Hello.
And we also have Dr. Stephen Irving.
Hi.
One of our ultrasound fellow extraordinaires. So, Steve, would you be willing to introduce yourself for a little bit and your background, your training, and where you're headed after this year?
Sure. So I just finished residency last year, graduated from Sinai Grace in Detroit, and I'm doing a one-year fellowship in ultrasound. I never touched an endocavitary probe before I got here, so this is always a lot of fun. Next year, I'm actually headed to San Francisco and going to be working at Kaiser.
Do I detect a hint of an accent?
That's a lovely accent you have. New Jersey?
Oh, you do. So I was originally born in South Africa, but since then I've lived in Houston, Texas, Seattle, the Caribbean, New York, California, Florida, Detroit, and out here.
I could hear the New York accent. I mean, you just can't hide it.
I try to keep it down, but sometimes.
Yeah, keep it down.
Anything that we say sounds better when Steven says it.
That's true.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. We always try to bait the ultrasound people into coming and talking about ultrasound, because they're really good at what they do, and yet when it's recorded, they tend to shy away. So Shrikar usually sends the fellows. So we appreciate you for coming, Stephen.
It's a very, it's a visual field, and so doing a podcast on ultrasound without any visuals is a little tricky, and Shrikar shies away from it. So thank you so much.
Matt and Matt do it, but discussing kind of how to use ultrasound is more what we're getting into, rather than, all right, imagine there's some red and some some blue flashes. You know, we're going to talk about, you know, the appropriateness, when to use it, when not, because we have lots of point-of-care ultrasound. We have endocavitary probes that we can use. We have ultrasonographers that are available 24 hours a day. And so when we're sending every woman with a pelvis to ultrasound, it can, you know, definitely cause not just angst to the emergency department, but to the patient themselves. So we want to talk a little bit first about ovarian torsion. So show of hands or show of hears, who has seen ovarian torsion?
I've seen it.
I have not.
I've seen it twice. And that's in almost 10 years now. So ovarian torsion is something that I feel like I look for all the time, but I'm never really expecting to find it. And when I do find it, I was either completely convinced that's what it was ahead of time, or it was like, oh, really? Huh. Never would have guessed that one. It's like when you have the patient with maybe a larger BMI, and it turns out that their whole pelvis is made of cyst, chocolate cyst, perhaps.
Uh-huh.
And you go, huh? So that's what that was. So,
from my anecdotal experience, they're exactly right. There are times when it's so classic, no one could have missed it. But what I'm more interested in are the ones that have been more subtle. I've had a case of several bounce backs that I found out later were eventually diagnosed with torsion. One of them was a 14-year-old girl. I was her second bounce back. She ended up following up with a PCP who also missed it. Finally went to TMC, where an astute physician who works with us actually found it and notified me that it was necrotic torsed. And that was a case of kind of an indolent presentation, not a significantly focal exam. And as we'll talk about in a few seconds here, that while that's not the norm, isn't super uncommon.
The two women that I saw with ovarian torsion, they came in, they had sudden onset of pelvic pain. They were pretty much like an in-training exam question. Sudden onset of pelvic pain. Pain dropped them to their knees, was excruciating, made them throw up. One lady passed out, it was so bad, and came in screaming, writhing. No matter what we could do, she couldn't get comfortable. And my first thought was, all right, is this a stone? But then she was very tender over her adnexa, and she ended up having about an 8 centimeter cyst. It was torsed, and it was one that I was so concerned about it that I sent her immediately for ultrasound, was calling, hassling them. They got her over there. It was torsed. She went to the OR. And the other one was very similar. I was like, this is a lady in a lot of pain. And my thought of how to work her up, which we'll talk about a little bit later, was, well, if it's a kidney stone and I delay getting imaging, no loss. If it's an ovary and I delay getting imaging, we've got some ischemia time we're dealing with here. So, you know, that unilateral pelvic pain, the pain that's excruciating, way out of proportion for what you would think. I mean, these were the things I thought that we should be looking for. So we actually looked to see, you know, how much literature is out there on ovarian torsion, and it's not a whole lot. You guys agree?
Yeah.
And exactly right. And not a lot on the acute presentation and the case series on acute presentation and what are the actual clinical factors that associate with torsion. Not a lot of data on that.
And all the studies that I found were very low numbers. Like they had 50 patients, 100 patients. A lot of them were retrospective of 10 to 15 years, where imaging modalities have changed a lot. So the utility at this point is questionable.
Made me feel right at home, because that's every pediatric paper ever. So some of the stuff we found, there are some studies that showed, for example, they took a questionnaire and asked women to fill out a bunch of stuff about how they felt when they had their torsion, and basically just tried to figure out what are the historical factors that make you concerned. So to summarize a couple of the factors that were a little bit more high risk. So unilateral pain. So if you've got pain that's on one side more than the other, absence of vaginal bleeding or vaginal discharge, unbearable pain was one of the interesting things that I saw in one of the studies. It's unbearable versus just, you know, it's okay. I can tolerate it. I just thought I'd come to the ER because vomiting, pain that's been there for less than 8 hours, 8 hours kind of threw me a little bit. And then if you find a cyst on ultrasound, the ovarian cyst is generally greater than 5 centimeters. And I think that's where we get that number from. I've heard that number for years and never really thought about where it came from. Well, that's what the book says. That's what UpToDate says. That's what the gynecology resident says. So looking at these factors, these are the ones that I thought, okay, pretty classic. You know, a patient that comes in with sudden onset of unilateral pain, no vaginal bleeding, no discharge, pain is excruciating, they're throwing up all over the place, and you get them to the ultrasound suite and find that they have torsion, this patient needs to go to the OR. But not everybody's that straightforward. So Chris, your patient didn't necessarily present like this one.
No. She had left lower quadrant pain, had been seen before at our emergency department, had a pretty good workup, but did not include any imaging, discharged home, came back again. I saw her a second time. Again, we didn't pursue any definitive imaging. I think we did a bedside ultrasound, if I remember right, but that was it. And we talked mom out of, you know, MRI or and even CT. She was 14 years old discharged to follow up with PCP. She did that. She followed up with the PCP, who also couldn't find anything really wrong. Then they finally got the diagnosis, and it was necrosed at that point.
When you saw her, how bad was the pain?
So subjectively, I don't remember her pain scale, but subjectively, I would say maybe a 4 out of 10.
Okay, so she looked pretty comfortable.
Well, I mean, she was tender, but not crazy tender. Yeah.
Stephen, you were telling me you even found some literature that said that patients don't necessarily need to have pain to have torsion.
Exactly. So some of the literature actually says on your pelvic exam, 30% of the patients who are torsed will actually have no pain, which again makes it incredibly difficult, especially if some of the presentation, you got right flank pain radiating to the right groin, it's intermittent, it's colicky, and some of them even have a little bit of blood in their urine. So if you do that and you do a physical that shows absolutely no tenderness, you're probably going to think kidney stone as opposed to an actual torsion.
Which nowadays we're not even trying to get a definitive diagnosis for kidney stone. We're trying to look for the secondary signs, hematuria, hydronephrosis on renal ultrasound to try to spare the radiation. So, you know, if you don't have hydronephrosis, maybe you got a couple red cells in your urine, yeah, sure, kidney stone. That sounds right. Or intermittent ovarian torsion. So I think what we can agree on is that that some of these are high risk factors. These are the ones you can't miss. And then, you know, the way I like to describe it is some patients are just a bomb that are going to go off in somebody's lap, you know, and somebody's going to find them, and maybe you're the second or the third or the fifth provider to see them. And now if they've got a necrosed ovary and they've got rebound tenderness and peritoneal signs, it's like, oh, well, clearly,
yeah,
I could have missed that, you know?
Very true.
It's been going on for quite a while. There was one study that actually tried to develop a predictive score for preoperative diagnosis of ovarian torsion. And the 5 criteria that they said stood out the most were unilateral lumbar or abdominal pain. So if the ovary is seated a little more retroperitoneally, you may have lumbar pain instead. Pain duration less than 8 hours at first presentation. Vomiting. Absence of vaginal discharge or vaginal bleeding, and a cyst larger than 5 centimeters on ultrasonography. So they kind of split these into low-risk and high-risk groups, and when they applied it, it did okay. It still wasn't 100% even specific. It turned out to be about 75% accurate in trying to figure out who does and who doesn't have torsion.
As far as specificity goes, what they did when they prospectively tried to validate it, though, they did find that if you did score low, they didn't miss any. So their negative predictive value there was actually very good.
So looking at these features, you definitely have to have a high suspicion. What kind of stuff, just from a clinical gestalt standpoint, would continue to make you concerned about ovarian torsion, even though they don't have any of these ultra-predictive historical factors. For me, one of the things I think of is if they've had manipulation of their ovaries before, maybe they've had cysts and had them removed. Maybe they've had a history of previous ovarian pathology, like even a younger girl that's had maybe an ovarian teratoma or a dermoid cyst removed. And then for women who are in childbearing age, thinking of somebody that's had in vitro fertilization or some other kind of fertility treatments.
I like this study. This is the French study you're talking about, the derivation of this torsion predictive score. And, you know, they took all of these different variables that they thought could theoretically be associated, you know, with coming up with a good clinical decision rule. And they gave them all p-values, and then from there they did this multiple logistic regression mumbo-jumbo that I don't understand. And then they came up with the final criteria that Aaron just mentioned. But what's interesting to me are some of the things that actually didn't pan out in the final clinical decision rule. Those are things like sudden onset of pain, which I would assume that's the kind of the med school teaching, right? Sudden onset. And those kind of bombastic cases that you've seen, Aaron, it sounds like they presented that way with pretty awesome sudden onset pain. I've seen those present that way too, and I'm assuming those are the ones that have complete, maybe even arterial occlusion, not just venous congestion. But that didn't pan out into the final cut, even though it did have a fairly decent p-value. Another one that had a really good p-value was the use of opioids analgesics, which I thought was kind of interesting, just the fact that you're requiring narcotics to control their pain. I think in our day, though, maybe in America, not in France, that may be a bit skewed. And then the final part there that I think didn't make it into the final cut but should still be considered is, for those of us who still believe in a bimanual exam, is the ability to palpate a mass in the adnexa. I'm going to be the first to admit that I rarely have palpated mass in the adnexa. I believe it exists. I believe that there are people who can get to the point where they can palpate it, maybe, or feel like they can palpate it. Although Steve just recently told us about some data that he's come across that says maybe that's bogus too. But if you look in if trying to differentiate torsion in pre-menarchal versus post-menarchal women, that's one of the few things that you can use to increase your sensitivity in the pre-menarchal. And I think maybe because their body habitus is a little lesser, that you should be able to get to the adnexa a little easier.
Not the bimanual exam in the pre-menarchal women, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Just abdominal palpation, because if you're advocating doing
right.
a bimanual on a six-year-old,
on a six-year-old,
I'm going to have to stop this podcast.
Correct,
right?
Correct. Yeah, but what they argue is that you should be able to often palpate a mass more likely in the premenarchal woman, transabdominally.
And we'll talk a little more about transabdominal versus transvaginal evaluation, because that comes in it's very important for your ultrasound as well. But Steve, what was your study that you found about how good we are at doing looking for pelvic masses?
Exactly. So I'll have to find the exact article. Can't find it right now. But the essence was patients were taken to the OR to get laparoscopic surgery, and the gynecologist attending, as well as a resident, palpated for adnexal masses. And I think they had a sensitivity of about 50% at best for actually palpating an adnexal mass, which was diagnosed during the laparoscopic surgery. So with our patient habitus, with the patients being uncomfortable in the ED, being under non-ideal circumstances, I honestly don't think we can do much better than that sometimes.
I think we proposed for one of our ScholarQuest projects to do a study of the positive predictive value of a bimanual exam in patients with a BMI greater than 60, I think. Basically to show that it's not useful.
It can be downright dangerous. Ask Dr. Pacheco.
Poor guy. We had to tie a rope to his ankle. So trying to palpate the mass is good, but if oftentimes when I have palpated an abdominal mass, first of all, it's usually poo. If it's a young child. But when they are that big that you can palpate, if they're sizable and take up a big portion of the abdominal cavity, it either feels like the whole thing is just part of the abdominal cavity,
yes.
Or it's so big that it won't really have any room to rotate on the pedicle. So if it's that sizable, you'll see it on ultrasound. It still needs to come out because something is pathologic there, but it's less likely to actually be torsed when it's that large. So. All right, so When we have this suspicion, though, we have somebody that makes us concerned, which, honestly, a lot of women, I get concerned. I don't feel like we need to find every ovarian cyst, every follicle that's ruptured, but you have to worry about torsion and maybe even a hemorrhagic ovarian cyst, which I've seen women bleed a fair amount from a hemorrhagic cyst. They look pale, their blood pressures are a little soft, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you need to go to the OR to get this thing clamped off. So we can't discount that either. Usually my first step is going to be to go to ultrasound. If I'm really concerned that they've got something ruptured, I'm going for my FAST first to see if there's anything there, whether it's a ruptured ectopic or a ruptured hemorrhagic cyst. When that's normal, I don't trust my skills to be able to look for ovarian torsion or an ovarian cyst at all. I've called several patients' bladders ovarian cysts and thought for sure that's what it is. In fact, I just looked and either Steve or Elaine just overread one of my pelvic ultrasounds and said, nope, not a cyst, that's the bladder. Does that happen to you guys a lot?
So with our credentialing, we don't actually have that many people do pelvic ultrasounds. Transabdominal, we actually do see kind of the opposite. We see some really, really large cysts that people think are bladder or with a bladder with diverticulum as well. What's nice, though, is when people do get the secondary imaging like the CT or the MRI, and it can help really delineate. And then when you go back to the ultrasound, you're like, oh, of course. But then that's the hindsight looking.
Any suggestions on how to differentiate between an ovarian cyst and the bladder? Because one thing that I think Shrikar has told me is that when you do have a sizable cyst, it tends to gravitate towards the midline.
Yes.
So if I'm looking at a big midline fluid-filled structure, I'm like, great, bladder.
Yeah, so honestly what I do is I have them pee and then I re-ultrasound them. And that's usually the best way to tell.
Gosh, common sense. So no fancy scoring systems, no high frequency, different probes.
I'm sure you could always use a spectral Doppler setting and really reaccumulate the angle and the speed velocity of the...
So you don't recommend sticking like a 18 gauge needle in there and just pulling out fluid and seeing what happens? Or...
All right, if you're going to use big words, I'll just have them pee. So so we're going to be going for ultrasound, and for the most part, I unless I'm seeing something that is clearly an ovary, which I can't tell the difference of, and it's clearly torsed, which I can't tell the difference of, I'm going to be sending them to ultrasound. Practically speaking, before we get into looking at ultrasound for the diagnosis of ovarian torsion, a lot of women, I think probably most women, have ovaries on the right side as well as the left. And so they also tend to have the appendix on that side. So I was in this conundrum for a long time before we started doing more MRIs, which our radiologists swear they could differentiate between GI and GYN pathology, which is very helpful when you're confused. But if you go to a place that doesn't have 24-hour MRI and they don't do abdominal MRIs all the time, then what is your decision tree of doing an ultrasound to look for torsion versus a CT scan to look for appendicitis?
If it's left-sided, it's a little bit easier. But as we were reading, somewhere between 60 to 80% of confirmed torsions are on the right side. So that's just God's little finger in our eye, I think. But if it's right lower quadrant pain, like I had an example last night with this woman, this 15-year-old girl was referred to us for concern for appendicitis, and she was darn right peritoneal on exam. As a matter of fact, we called the surgeons, and they weren't available to come in right away, pediatric surgeons. They recommended ultrasound because they wanted to rule out. She was thin, and they thought, well, let's see if we can see torsion or appendicitis and avoid radiation, avoid the time sink of an MRI. Well, you know where this is headed. Ultrasound didn't really show anything definitive, and so MRI happens, and that's where I find myself now is not jumping straight to an ultrasound because I find it so uncertain so frequently, and even in cases where they're saying we think the appendix looks normal, we're not 100% sure, recommend MRI. I'm almost at the point now where if I'm concerned clinically enough that there's something cooking in the right lower quadrant, I'm starting with an MRI. And Lisa Chan's probably standing right behind me, isn't she, right now? Yeah?
So we actually have some interesting, we're looking at the time. Obviously, the patient comes in, they get the ultrasound, and they get the CT. it actually seems to be a little bit shorter to get the MRI, first of all. Because we've all had those cases where, like you said, you get the ultrasound, and you're like, oh, man, I don't know what this is. So then you go for the CT, and then the amount of time that takes is over the amount of time it would take to get that MRI for an acute disease process.
And last night when I was working with the residents, we had this discussion, actually, and we talked about how we would practice out in the real world. And I realized that our use of the MRI here is not how it works out there. And so for me to tell them, well, in this situation, it may be more efficient to get the MRI is probably unique to here. And when I say it's more efficient, there's even internally we have debate about that. I've waited a lot longer on ultrasounds in some cases than I have on MRI. But out in the community, that's not going to be an option for them. So we need to come up with a different algorithm for our graduating residents.
So what I used to do, and I've seen that as well, think about ultrasound. It's operator dependent. It's how quickly an operator can get this patient to hold still and get the views that they need to view. And then when the radiologist looks at it, they're looking at static images of a dynamic study. And so they've only got a few. So maybe they send them back and get some more. And I kind of maybe saw something there. Why don't you do some more? It can take a while. I think ultimately ultrasound has the potential to be a better test because it is so dynamic. But depending on what you're looking for, it's operator dependent. It can be 100% sensitive, or it can be 45, or it can be 10. In my case, it's 10% sensitive, which is less than a coin flip. Maybe I should just carry around a lucky coin.
An 8-ball.
Yeah, exactly. Does this patient have a ovarian torsion? And shake the 8-ball, ask again later.
That's
always what I'm going to get. Yeah, for me, the differentiation, first of all, is going to be clinically. Do they seem to have any of the symptoms that lead me more towards appendicitis versus ovarian torsion, being that maybe they don't have anorexia like you would see with appendicitis. Maybe they have a mass. Maybe they're, if they have more of the guarding, they've got a big leukocytosis, some of the labs that can help you. Although even in the youngest of kids, they can mount a fever with ovarian torsion, which
absolutely
blew my mind. And the median time for us to actually find torsion in premenarchal girls is on the order of days, sometimes. Days! Because we're admitting them for serial abdominal exams, and no one ever, in pediatrics, I gotta admit, I'm guilty, even though I did EMPs, I don't think of the ovaries as much until they start functioning. As soon as you start menstruating, now that you have my attention, but before then, no, I'm not really thinking this is ovaries. It's gotta be the appendix, right?
Yeah, and pediatrics are also more difficult. In adult patients over 18, most of them actually do have some kind of mass on their ovary, so it's not a completely normal on ultrasound or laparoscopic. Pediatrics, over 50% of them have completely normal architecture of their ovary, so it makes it even more difficult.
So what I tend to do is, if I'm concerned, if I'm concerned specifically about torsion because they have all of the classic findings of torsion, I'm going to call ultrasound and say, I have a girl who has all the classic signs of torsion. She needs to go right now. If I've got a patient that's got all the classic signs of appendicitis, I'm getting a CT. And if I'm not sure, what I used to do was I would get an ultrasound first, because the torsion is time sensitive. It's ischemia. And if I didn't know, I would say go to ultrasound first and see if there's ischemia that needs to be taken to the operating room right now, versus appendicitis that we can cool off with some antibiotics. And, even now the surgeons won't necessarily take them right in the middle of the night. It's not the emergency it was 20 years ago. So that has been my approach. And in the community, that's what I've done. However, in the community, from what I've heard from people, it's so much easier to just get the CT. And if you see a mass, then you're done. If you see that there's something clearly wrong with the ovaries, then that's probably where you need to go. However, I think you then have to talk a gynecologist to take that patient to the operating room without all of the magical ultrasound findings.
And before we jump into the CT stuff, which I find very, very fascinating, when is a gynecology consultation jumping into your algorithm in a case that presents kind of classically? Someone looks bad. Do you call them, and you're suspicious for torsion, do you call them before you have imaging?
So I was trained in a very different facility. In Detroit, we have less resources, and for a while, we actually didn't have an ultrasonographer on 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. We had them during the day, and at night, you had to call them in.
Which is how it works in the community, too.
Exactly. So the way my algorithm would work, if I had high enough probability, I would call in the resident or attending and be like, hey, I'm sorry, but I think I have this. We're going to get some imaging now, but if you could come right away, that'd be great. Like, mm-hmm. that was my algorithm.
And the email thread that we had, maybe a little less than a year ago, their department actually said they wanted us to be called. Now, of course, this comes from high above, not from their residents, but they said they wanted to be called for cases that we were clinically suspicious of before imaging.
And our OB-GYN residents are really good here about coming down. They're in the middle of catching babies and everything else, and they have to come down eight flights and down the hall, and you know, in order to come over and see one of our consults. It sounds silly, but one of the ones I had where I called them right away, I was so convinced this was a torsion. Why? Because I said, have you ever had ovary problems before? Yes, I had my left ovary torsed. Mm-hmm. Did it feel like this? Yes, it did. Great.
Yeah.
Let me make some phone calls.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's that easy, and sometimes it's not. So I think when it's clearly straightforward that, man, this is a board question, I'm calling ahead of time and saying, look, I'm sending this person to ultrasound right now. I'm going over there with them. Will you meet me over there? And, you know, we'll see what this looks like. It's especially with something like ectopic pregnancy, if they've got positive pregnancy test and they've got bad pain, that's often good enough for me if they've got rebound tenderness and a positive fast. But with torsion, I'll be honest, I haven't come across that often enough to really say, oh, here's what I always do. Generally, I would wait because I'm not certain in my diagnostic ability.
Yeah, me too. That's where I'm at. And so I think even though it's easy for me to say, well, in the obvious clinical scenario, I would get GYN involved, that obvious clinical scenario just doesn't happen frequently enough.
I agree.
So once we figured out what kind of imaging modality we're going to do, we're probably going to end up with an ultrasound at some point. And sometimes when I've had like a big cyst on CT and I've just said, man, this is a sizable cyst, 10 centimeters, I call GYN, you know, this has got a risk of torsion. Well, they want the ultrasound. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit since we have Steven here. I feel like I should have shaved my head today. I'm really sorry. and grown a sweet beard. I actually walked in and I saw Steve sitting at the picnic tables. I said, hey, C-Dubs, Steve, hey. you got to learn the South African accent and see how long you can pretend that he's still here next year.
If you want, I have a white coat you could borrow.
There you go. Yeah, just see if people notice. So we're probably going to end up with an ultrasound at some point. When we have ultrasound, we get it back, and I will look at a lot of ultrasounds now that we've had good training from our fellows and our ultrasound faculty. I'll look at the ultrasound for a DVT. I'll look at the ultrasound for a gallbladder. If I look at the ultrasound for torsion, I'm like, I don't know. So, Steve, even if I don't do the actual procedure, even if I'm not interpreting it, what are some things I can look for while the radiologist is looking at it to say, maybe I should call radiology right now because this is concerning?
So a few of the studies that we were reading about basically had a few different criteria in which the radiologists met ahead of time and said, okay, what things are we going to look for in order to think maybe this is torsion versus something else? One of them we kind of discussed already is like having a large ovary with a measurement over 5 centimeters. So that goes back to the whole idea, if there's a cyst over 5 centimeters, it's definitely a risk factor for having a torsion. They also say the ovary volume greater than 15 centimeters cubed. I actually don't know how I would measure that.
And they're usually round, too, so that doesn't help.
How many marbles is that?
Most of the stuff I'd have a lot of trouble diagnosing, and I know a lot of the ultrasound faculty, I think, would too. Like a whirlpool sign, where you actually have the twisted pedicle and the vasculature is all twisted and it gives this kind of strange sign. Presence of fluid in the pelvis, you can actually often see, but then sometimes that's normal for a patient.
Yeah, it can be normal physiologic fluid from just a ruptured cyst during ovulation, right?
Exactly. So it's very difficult, I think, as to look at the scans and say this is something I'm concerned about other than just certain size as well as some free fluid. And that's about all I would honestly say I'd be able to tell at this point.
You know, going with the corollary of testicular torsion, I feel like that's easier to figure out. You can look at the testicle and you can look at Doppler flow and see if there's, you know, a hyperemic testicle or a testicle that doesn't, that's devoid of any blood flow. Similar with torsion, of where you can look at it and kind of look at the Doppler signal of one side versus the other?
Sadly not. So with males, we're quite lucky. Everything's external. We know that testicle hurts. We can ultrasound that thing, and you get the exact imaging you want. With pelvic pathology, it's a little more difficult. So first of all, the ovaries actually have two blood supplies, the uterine and ovarian arteries. And when they twist, the first thing to go is the venous. And then the lymphatics get also occluded. It starts to get bigger, edematous, a little bit of hemorrhage, necrosis. It eventually occludes also the artery as well. So when they do Doppler studies, they've shown that with proven torsion with laparoscopic surgery, they still have normal flow in about 40 to 50% of them. Mm-hmm. So if you have normal flow in something you're trying to rule out, it's very, very difficult to really use that test as the end-all, be-all.
So that brings us pretty much to where we end up a lot of times. Equivocal study. Patient still has pain, and whether it's excruciating pain or tolerable pain, maybe they've got a small cyst there. It's 4 centimeters, probably 4.9 centimeters, not quite 5, but 4.9 centimeters. What do we do now?
And you've got positive arterial flow on a Doppler.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so out in the community, those patients go home. And I think we're at the cutting edge here where maybe we should try to push our residents as they go out into the community to push back a little bit on those situations. And that would at least push back, meaning a gynecology consult.
I was talking with one of our alumni, and he said, you know, I don't do nearly as many MRs or pelvic ultrasounds as you guys do in your ivory tower of academia. And there's not a lot of one-ovaried women walking around where I work, you know, because I missed it. So this is a bit of playing the odds. You know, it's not something that happens all the time. But how risk adverse, how risk tolerant are you with your patient's fertility? Although Steve found some somewhat reassuring news of that fertility might not be as big of an issue if you get one shot at missing it.
You get one shot at missing it. Yes, so there was a analysis. Basically, about 40 patients had a oophorectomy with one ovary removed, and they did follow-ups for an entire 10 years, and they noticed that their ability to reproduce was the same as someone who had both ovaries. That doesn't mean the lawyers aren't going to get you and get you in a lot of trouble. It just means on one study with a small amount of people, they had the same fertility rates.
And that also doesn't mean that it was as easy as it would be with two ovaries. So the time that it takes for a woman to conceive is often a source of lots of angst and lots of trouble. So maybe eventually they got pregnant, but you know, at what cost and at what time?
Correct.
So I think that having a discussion with the gynecologist in your community, the ones that are on call, and talking with them about not just their comfort levels, but their understanding of this as well, in these kind of rare circumstances would be useful. I mean, it's really good when you're in the community to have the cell phone numbers of the people that you need to get a hold with. You do them a favor, they do you a favor. I mean, I don't work in the community, but I still get calls from our subspecialists. I just got one the other night. Hey, I'm a pediatric cardiologist. You sending me a patient? No, maybe. I was mountain bike riding, and one of my friends took a header and having a lot of trouble breathing and some like shoulder pain. Do you think they might have a pneumo? I was like, sounds good to me, man. Send them in. And now when I call him back, I go, hey, I got a really stupid question for you. Well, he owes me one.
That's right. So let's talk about the situation where someone comes in with a little bit more of a vague abdominal pain that justifies getting a CT scan. And you get that CT scan and it shows something abnormal going on in the pelvis, either torsion, or sometimes they'll call torsion, sometimes they'll just say ovarian pathology, recommend ultrasound for follow-up. Who does not get an ultrasound when they say get an ultrasound? I think we all do, right? There's a study that came out of Rhode Island a few years ago in 2014 that says maybe we don't need to repeat the ultrasound.
Yes. So they took two radiologists and they showed them a handful of ultrasounds and CTs and tried to see how good they were. So for CT, radiologist number one was 100% sensitive and radiologist number two was 90% sensitive. And for ultrasound, it actually went down a little bit. Radiologist number one was 80% sensitive and number two was 80% sensitive as well. So do you really need both studies? And I think that my take on this was, for the majority of people, it's probably not going to make a difference. If they can see it on one modality, they'll probably see it on the other. And the thing that always throws me to do a little bit more, because no radiologist is 100% sensitive. Some of them are pretty sensitive, you know, depending on how much you tease them. But if they're, no radiologist is 100% sensitive. So if I'm concerned clinically, then guess what? I'm going to correlate clinically and say, I don't agree. I think this patient's having something really bad. They've got bad pain. I'm going to get the other study. Or I'm going to admit them to the hospital or call the consultant or somebody else who will correlate clinically and help me get to the bottom of why this patient's having so much pain.
I like this study because it brings up an interesting, you know, point that may actually affect my flow in the emergency department, i.e. I don't get an ultrasound if a CT shows something going on in the pelvis. But I think some of the conclusions they make may be a little premature. First of all, the radiologists were told beforehand that they were going to be evaluating for torsion in these images. Now, obviously, some of those images weren't going to be torsion. I think they went into it thinking this is kind of a test of our ability to pick up torsion or be fooled by something that might be torsion. So they ended up having some false negatives and false positives in there. But their final conclusion, which says, you know, that maybe we can avoid getting ultrasound that would delay therapy, is a little premature because we don't know what would have happened with that ultrasound. So I think the study needs to maybe be done in a different way in the future now that this has come out, which is do the CT and then do the ultrasound and see if that changes disposition or changes management. Because what I can see happening if I use this this study right now is I call our OB-GYNs and say, hey, there's a study that shows that doing an ultrasound isn't going to increase my sensitivity for torsion, and right now I'm suspicious for torsion on the CT. And they'll say, well, we still want the Doppler because I still want to know if there's arterial flow or not.
And there is a point at which you can't force the surgeon's hands to make that cut. I mean, you have to convince them. Same as sometimes you have to convince patients that they're okay and they can go home. But I still have some pain. Yeah, is it better? Yeah, I guess it is better. All right, well, you know, come home. Here are the things to look out for. Here are your return precautions. In the same way, you have to convince your surgeon this is not okay. This patient has to go to the operating room. And sometimes you have to have seen one of these, and you can quote the almighty N of one. The last time I had this, not the only one I've ever seen, the last time I had this, that could be 15 years ago, this is what happened, and that patient had torsion. And sometimes you get usually the younger surgeons that haven't seen these, they go, all right, fine. Mm-hmm. The older surgeons would be like, oh yeah, when was that? That's beside the point. All in all, this is a tough disease to pick up. Usually when we pick a topic like this that's open for debate, that doesn't have a whole lot of literature to support it, we come up with suggestions of, yeah, just keep doing what you're doing. Good luck to you. But hopefully with some of this evidence, you can pick up some of the ones that are a higher chance of having something. I know this actually made me more concerned, and I'm probably going to be thinking a little bit more about younger women, younger girls, and thinking about torsion in them with intermittent colicky abdominal pain. Because my first thought is intussusception. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, it's probably intussusception. Now, granted, we get an ultrasound, but we're doing transabdominal, and that's the last thing we haven't talked about is transabdominal versus transvaginal. Transabdominal ultrasound is almost next to worthless for me in the emergency department. Steve, would you mind describing the process by which you do a appropriate transabdominal ultrasound?
So when you're looking at the bladder, if you're looking at the pelvic area, you're doing transabdominal, you want the bladder to be as full as possible. This allows the ultrasound waves to go through and delineate what goes on behind. How many fast do you think you guys have done?
Thousands?
Thousands. How many times have you guys seen an ovary?
Ooh.
Well, I thought it was a bladder. So.
Yeah, that's a good question. Maybe 50?
Yeah, so if you think about thousands of scans with only seeing something you're not really looking for about 50 times, it shows you the utility, at least in an adult, to do the transabdominal ultrasound to look at the actual ovaries.
So for me, that makes a big difference because I've had that patient who I chose to do it or was signed out to me. They're waiting on an abdominal ultrasound to look at the ovaries. And I go, oh, man, this is going to be forever because we're waiting for the little girl to get her bladder filled up enough. Oh, but then she peed a little bit. Sorry. Oh, yeah, we needed to get the urine so that you could get the urine test. And so now it's empty again. You know, what Steve suggested earlier of, well, re-ultrasound them after they peed, that's easy. Re-ultrasounding them and waiting for their bladder to fill up is tough. And even then, I have never gotten a great definitive read because it's not a great modality to look for the ovaries. So in that case, that is another one where if I'm really concerned about ovaries, I'm going for MRI. And CT in the community is what I would go to if I was really concerned. I think that in a virginal girl that's never had intercourse before, a transvaginal ultrasound, a pelvic exam is unnecessary and quite intrusive. So if I can get a good look with some kind of cross-sectional imaging, then that's generally good enough for me.
Would you do a CT in those kids?
I would do a CT in those kids. It's radiation versus something that's probably going to stick with them a whole lot longer. And then ultrasound that is very unlikely to give me a definitive answer for what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm. I have a question then. How about... Now, knowing what we know about these torsion scoring rules, the sensitivity of CT, what would you say to an ED physician feeling trained not enough to evaluate the ovary very well, but enough to say whether or not there's a 5-centimeter cyst? Do you think we could get to the point where we could exclude a 5-centimeter or greater cyst transabdominally?
Transabdominally, I think that would be tough. Honestly, I don't know enough about that at this point, but yeah.
I like to think that they're big enough that I shouldn't miss it, but I think I would.
I'm certain I would, especially after looking after some of my scans that have been reread. I'm pretty certain I wouldn't be able to pick it up. And you got squirmy kids that don't really want to sit still. Because these age groups of where you're having torsion, this is going down into the age 6, age 7. I mean, they get young and they have torsion. And even with those kids, they don't present necessarily the same as they do when they're older. They're not going to have the sudden onset pain. They're going to have
delayed presentation, less likely to have cysts.
They'll be restless. They don't want to sit still. They'll have fever sometimes. Hopefully they'll have a mass. That would be really nice, but the chances of me finding the mass, I think, are going to be pretty low. So for these kids, I'm going with some kind of cross-sectional imaging, MRI if I can help it, or CT if I can't. And then pediatricians are pushing. Overs. They don't mind watching a kid overnight because they recognize that it's a lot of veterinary medicine sometimes. I can't get a great history. I can't do an appropriate exam. I think we need to do some blood work. I think we need to do some imaging. And if I still can't get them to feel better, let's watch them overnight and see what happens.
According to that Australian study, the standard of care is to miss torsion in a premenarchal girl.
This is very similar to aortic dissection, subarachnoid hemorrhage. If you miss it, then the fallout can be devastating, but it's also not something that you see all the time. And so how do you, Peter Rosen hates this word, this term, how do you keep a high index of suspicion? Well, you can ultrasound absolutely every person that comes in with pelvic pain, or you can start looking for these high-risk features. You can do serial abdominal exams, and you can talk with the patient about how they feel, and you know, give them some options, do a little shared decision making, which I am a huge fan of.
And don't forget the torsion predictive score.
Torsion predictive score was pretty cool. So if they've got any of those features, it's going to make me a little more concerning.
I just want to give a little... So we have a very strong radiology department here, and the ultrasound sections discussed this actually with them a few times just because it's such a difficult diagnosis. Speaking with some of them, they essentially gave us the idea that MRIs are much better delineating the different structures in a female pelvis versus CT, which is a lot of gray. Mm-hmm. And you can actually delineate a mass as well as the ovary and see if there's actually flow going to the ovary specifically with MRI, as opposed to CT, where it can all look like just one mass, and it's very hard to assess whether or not it's the mass causing the pain or it's the ovary that may be torsion.
And the secondary signs of torsion, detorsion that you'll see on an MR and won't see on ultrasound.
Correct.
There is such a thing as retorsion of an ovary. They'll take them in and do the, what is it, oopexy, which is such a cool word. And they'll tack the ovary down to where it should be. If they don't do that, you can retorse.
So the gold standard is still to do laparoscopic or laparotomy to assess for torsion. So with all our imaging that we have, we still have to use some of our clinical decision, what we think is going on, plus imaging, plus lab work, as well as speaking with the specialists. I think it's a very difficult topic and very difficult to assess.
I like what John Justo has told me, which is if the imaging doesn't show anything, get some labs. And if the labs don't show anything, do a physical exam. And if all else fails, take a history. Words to live by.
Is that too loud?
Woo! Woo! Woo!
Man, it feels good to be back. Holy cow, I'm on a podcast. I'm on the Aaron Leach podcast. I'm doing it. This feels so good. This is Matty T. Some of you may remember me. Or you've heard about me. I have many accolades. I saved John Sackles from a difficult airway once. I taught Jared Mosier how to use ECMO. That was fun. I introduced Srikar to ultrasound. That was a while ago. And I still have a restraining order against Allie Minch. She will not leave me alone. It's kind of awkward now. Anyways, I am out here in sunny Jacksonville Beach, Florida, and I'm loving it. It's beautiful. I just had a nice little jog on the beach in the nude. And now I am doing a podcast for you guys about ovarian torsion. I had to look that up. I forgot what that was. I have only seen ovarian torsion once since I left residency. And it was kind of an odd case, but let me tell you about where I work. I work in a number of different hospitals. I work for a large Democratic group that staffs 8 hospitals in Jacksonville. I primarily work at a couple podunk community places where you are on your own. And then I work at one downtown large facility that has everything at your greedy little fingertips. So when I saw ovarian torsion, it was about a year ago, and it was in an 18-year-old female, and she was rather large and in charge, and she had a very, very large ovarian cyst. And she came in complaining of abdominal pain. I had no idea what was going on, and I did a CAT scan. This girl had a whopping 23-centimeter cyst and a necrotic ovary. Needless to say, she went to the OR, but you know, that tissue was dead and gone by that time. So, can I just say something really quick? Chris Williams, oh my goodness, hearing your voice, I just automatically think of, you know, your handsome face, your tanned, chiseled forearms, probably wearing a, G-Shock, white G-Shock watch right now when you're listening to this, and some form of a nylon braided bracelet. I guarantee you he is, and somebody go find him and confirm this for me. Anyways, you're a handsome devil. I miss you too. So, pelvic pain versus abdominal pain, you guys talked about this a lot. the reality is, I see approximately between, you know, 2.5 to 3 patients an hour. I'm going to be real honest. When a female patient comes in with right lower quadrant pain, I'm not going to rely on a pelvic exam to distinguish whether there's a mass or whether this is appendicitis or ovarian torsion, simply because I've been fooled so many times. I mean, I've done a pelvic exam on a female who I was convinced was pelvic related pain. Ultrasound was negative and she had appendicitis. So it's just not really reliable to me. If they're in severe pain, I will likely just go for a CAT scan first, because ultrasound takes so long to do, and it takes a tech to come down and do it. And yeah, I know what you're saying. Wait, aren't you fellowship trained and aren't you the ultrasound director for your group? Yes, I am, but I'm not going to base my judgment off of a transvaginal ultrasound, because frankly I just don't do very many of them, and also we don't have a transvaginal probe where I'm at, and the time and resources that it's going to take me to sit down and do that, I mean, let's all be realistic here, it's just probably not going to happen. The times when I will not do a CAT scan or try to avoid it and do an ultrasound first are usually the young reproductive age females who come in and say, this feels like pelvic pain or ovarian pain, or I've had ovarian cysts in the past. I think Leacher kind of hit on that. So those are pretty obvious. I mean, get the ultrasound first. And if that's, you know, positive, great. If it's negative, then, and they're still in severe pain, you can move on to your CAT scan. You guys spent a good chunk of time talking about calling obstetrics and saying, hey, I've got an exam that is just a slam dunk for ovarian torsion. Can you come down and evaluate the patient? I don't have any imaging yet. That is not gonna happen, sorry. In the community, that's just not gonna happen. The only time I've had obstetrics come down or gyn come down is when you have somebody with a known to them, or has, like, you know, postpartum, you know, hemorrhaging, or, you know, preeclampsia or something, you know, that's a slam dunk. They're not going to come down for lower quadrant abdominal pain without imaging, at least at my facility. They'll laugh at you. So, you know, for me, having kind of actual evidence for why I'm consulting them is important. In a perfect world, they would come down. That would be great. I think it's great when you're at an academic center and you have residents who want to participate in that part of the differential diagnosis and exam and save people imaging or radiation or time. But in the community, it just does not work that way, at least not in my experience. If you're catching a ovarian torsion on CAT scan, which is the only time I've caught one, and OB wants an ultrasound, I think that's fine. In my perspective, when you're working so quickly down the ER, you really just want a diagnosis and you want a dispo. And so if the CAT scan shows ovarian torsion or symptoms or signs of ovarian torsion, I'm calling OB. They're on their way down to see the patient. Whether they want an ultrasound or not, it's really not up to me. I mean, they're the one who's going to fix this anyway. So I wait and I'll call them. I don't order an ultrasound and wait for that to come back to call them. I just call them and say, this is what the CAT scan shows. Come down to see the patient. They have always been good with that. In fact, any consultant has usually been pretty good with that once you have evidence of something on CAT scan. So in that lit review that you guys provided showed that CT scan was pretty darn sensitive. So if I have an iffy patient who has a lot of pain, I honestly don't have any reason to suspect an ovarian torsion, but they have lower quadrant pain, I'm likely going to go for the CT first, just because it's going to probably give me the information I need to determine it's ovarian in nature. And then I can call OB and move on from there. Okay, now onto the kiddos. In the community, I see kids all the time, and we don't have pediatrics where I work, so we have to transfer them out by a kids care ambulance or by flight if necessary. So when a kid comes in with lower quadrant pain, and I mean, honestly, I don't usually think ovarian torsion at all. I mean, if it's left lower quadrant pain and it's severe, that is, you know, certainly a concern. I will attempt a abdominal ultrasound to see if I see anything at the bedside. I'll talk with the parents. If the kid still looks crummy, I'm going to offer them one of two things. And this actually applies for right lower quadrant pain too. I will say, do you want to just go downtown in an ambulance and possibly forgo doing a CAT scan and see how your kid, you know, feels? Or do you want to get a CAT scan here, know for sure if this is just a viral illness or if this is appendicitis or if this is ovarian torsion, and be done with it? And if it's negative and your kid feels better, then you can go home. And otherwise, if your kid doesn't feel better, you can still be transferred, but at least we'll have an answer. And to be honest with you, most parents, even after explaining the radiation, I mean, it is a one-time radiation dose. That's usually what I say. They always, most always want to do the CAT scan. And if the kid just looks crummy enough, then I'm just going to transfer anyways. Do I rely on my ability to rule out appendicitis or ovarian cyst in a kid on my transabdominal ultrasound? You know, sometimes you get really skinny kids and you can definitely say there is no cystic structure in there. Obviously, I would not use it to rule out appendicitis. The literature doesn't support that at all either. But you know what? If you see it, it's great. If you don't see anything and the kid has really severe pain, I'm not going to trust that. I'm not going to rule anything out. But I always try it myself. And if I don't see anything, I'm not going to waste the family and the kid's time by ordering a quote-unquote formal ultrasound. So my point-of-care ultrasound is a really important tool for me because, first of all, it's a dynamic study. I can know exactly where they're having pain, and I can try to find either, you know, a large cystic structure or a blind tubular structure that's consistent with appendicitis. So, and if I can't find it, you know what? I can either scan the kid after talking to the parents or I can transfer him out, but at least I know that I tried to avoid radiation and get an answer. I'm sure you'll notice I haven't mentioned MRI yet. MRI is, you know, largely unavailable, and I used it far more in residency than I do now. We do have MRI techs, but it's just a study that takes several hours to get done. So it's very laborious and difficult. But if I have time, then it's certainly a possibility. But I can tell you right now, I rarely ever use it, unfortunately. And neither do my colleagues. It's just something that we don't really have available a lot of the time. So we kind of have to make a joint decision with the parents. All right, so that's my perspective. I'm sticking to it. It is heavily biased on my working situation, but I'm glad to be a part of this podcast. I will see you guys when I see you, but likely if you want to see me, you're going to have to come to my house because I'm having a baby and I will be in captivity for the next year. Medi-T out.